number two, tape number two with Mr. Parviz Rauji, again on the 9th of April 1986 at his home in London. We had got so far as by asking how the liberalization measures that Hoveyda had in mind did not take place, rather reverse if we judge by rumors. So carry on. So we were about. So why didn't? Why the opposite happened?
Well, I'm saying that Hoveyda at that time had formed an impression of what was the required priority to the Iran liberalization, and he had formed the judgment that the Shah was someone he could speak to. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think it's fair to say that he was possibly disappointed in later years in both. I remember 3 or 4 months subsequently to that, he came down from one of his audiences with the Shah. If you remember, there was a weekly satirical publication in Tehran called, the name will come to me in a minute, but they...
Tawfiq,
exactly. Tawfiq. And they had written an article or printed a cartoon which was mildly irreverent of one of the claims of the then mayor. And the mayor, of course, had been wounded by this...
What was his name?
Nikpe. And he had complained to the Shah about the attack on him by the press. And I think that particular publication had either been told to cool it, or was closed down, or the government advertisements, which in a sense subsidized all these publications, had been withdrawn. And Hoveyda, who cultivated a kind of, at least initially, a kind of contact with the press, and would devote great amount of hours to receiving people of the press and listening to their grievances and things, raised this with the Shah, this banning of the Tawfiq or Nikpe's complaint. And he came down from one of his audiences, and I remember he'd gone up there with great hope. And I knew the subjects that he was going to raise with His Majesty. I never knew the replies, quite honestly. But what was included in the dispatch box that he was taking up with him, for instance, there was the question of Tawfiq and the cutting, etc. So I knew what had gone into the box. When he came back, I allowed myself to ask what in fact had happened to the fate of Tawfiq, because the Tawfiq man was himself ringing up the whole time saying, well, do we publish, do we not publish? And Hoveyda was ashen-faced, and he said, no, His Majesty said that tolerating criticism is a kind of profusi, and I think profusi is best translated in English as a kind of spineless, wimpish, feeblish attitude to a critical view of yourself. So, I mean, you are right. With the passage of time and with the growth of his power, the Shah became less rather than more tolerant. But Hoveyda, of course, was too much of a politician ever to openly either admit this to me or to himself. Also, I think his idea of liberalization at that time was perhaps totally different to what subsequently during Carter's administration was again brought to bear on the Shah. I think at that time Haveda really meant a greater tolerance of newspaper attacks on ministers, perhaps a slightly more active majlis or parliament, and this and an absence of this kind of oversensitivity, which really equates any kind of criticism with either traitorous disloyalty or even worse, and which did ultimately so much harm to, I think, the Shah himself even. Because the minute he tried to liberalize, the condensation underneath had been so great that the lid blew off, of course. And,
and what Haveda was also perhaps under the influence of Abdullah Intizam, or perhaps by temperament, himself always claimed to be a Sufi and rather detached from material concerns and so forth. This was borne out, if I may be allowed to put a slight personal touch here, because I think it would be interesting for future reference, by the fact that he came to see my father often, mm-hmm. even when he was in power, and listened to him and asked him certain things. So obviously he had that side to him. Now, why didn't he at that point, if you say he was disappointed, why didn't he say, well, this is like Mr. Intizam, say, well, this has become too difficult for me, I just retire or go back to the Foreign Office or something?
A very good question. He didn't have, I believe, the kind of towering commitment to the sophistic tradition which Intizam had. There had been hundreds of people, literally, who had expressed views in opposition to those held by the Shah, people of very valid backgrounds, people of very sound judgment, people of unquestioned patriotism, and of course they had been fired from their positions, and I could name 100 names. And it had also become a kind of a joke not to go and create waves when you saw His Majesty. And the name that was always cited, and I think in my book I make a brief reference to it every time I wanted to say something, people would say to one, remember Intizam. That he resigned because he cherished his own convictions more highly than the post that he held, but what did he accomplish? He went and lived in his apartment, and the country was, if you like, robbed of his considerable intelligence and talent, etc., etc. So the dominant trait was one stayed on and did what one could from within, rather than stay outside the ring and simply jeer that this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong.
So you mean that he weighed the possibilities of what would be most beneficial to the country, whether he stayed or whether he went? Or was he just so addicted to the power that he thought he might...
It's a very nebulous area, all this, isn't it? I mean, particular point do we say that this is the straw which is going to break the back of the camel? And as far as I know, and I think this is perhaps the only instant, there was one occasion in 1972, I think, when Haveda said to His Majesty through an intermediary, that if I'm not wanted, I'll go. I don't think he ever had the temerity actually to submit his resignation and go. But he took soundings, if you like. And you may remember the occasion. The occasion was, I think it's 72, the Shah had been skiing in Switzerland. One member of his entourage, who was known to be an opium addict, an immensely rich man, he has since dead, the matter appeared in all the papers at the time. So
what was his name?
I'm not
spilling any beans. So what was his name?
Libeling him or slandering him. His name was Amir Hoshangi Davallu.
What was his job?
He didn't really have a job, but he was a trusted aide and confidant of the Shah. The Shah had given the concession for the sale of caviar in Europe, so he was really immensely rich. He was no smuggler, if you like, of opium, but he was a user of it. And whether there was some chicanery in Geneva or what happened, I don't exactly know. But when the Swiss customs go through his hand luggage or something, they discover a stick of opium. And because he was part of the Shah's entourage and he had a diplomatic passport, rank was pulled, and he boards the Shah's private plane and returns to Tehran. Now, the press, and particularly Le Monde, the press that was hostile to the Shah, massacred us over this. And they all pointed out that Iran had enacted legislation that said that any person in possession of so much opium would be tried by a military court and executed, because he was Jew. And they said that up to date in Iran, up to that particular time in Iran, 130 people had faced the firing squad for precisely what Amir Hoshangi Davallu had done at Geneva Airport. But of course, because he was the Shah's trusted aide, instead of facing the firing squad, he was escorted to the Royal Aeroplane by the Chief of Protocol of the Swiss government. And it just went on, and for about 10 days it wouldn't die. The Shah was in a very angry mood. On arrival at Tehran Airport, Hoveyda, who was also addicted to reading Le Monde, and was aware of this flak, massive amount of flak, which we had received, raises this matter with the Shah. I don't really know how he phrased it, but I heard from him subsequently. But the Shah had said, if I had left Amir Hoshangi behind in Geneva to clear up the matter, and it could have been cleared up. He could have, for medical reasons, say that if I don't have my opium, I'll die or something. The Shah had said precisely this to Hoveyda. He said that if I had let the Swiss authorities detain Amir Hoshangi, he would have died in detention. To which Hoveyda had said, Your Majesty, that would have been infinitely preferable to what has happened now. And Hoveyda told me this himself. He said, I hadn't quite finished my sentence when I could see a kind of angry iridescence in the Shah's eyes. And he turns from Hoveyda, boards his helicopter, and I think it was the weekend, goes off to the Caspian. Hoveyda was not summoned to see His Majesty for two or three days. There are no telephone calls. And curiously enough, the intermediary, who will remain nameless, who was a kind of harmless buffoon, who was a courtier and also a friend of Hoveyda's, is called into the act, and he goes up with a message from Hoveyda to the Shah, saying that if Your Majesty thinks that my services as Prime Minister are no longer required, needless to say, I would resign forthwith. To which the answer had come back, no, you may stay on as Prime Minister. Now this was the only instance in her Vedas, 12 years as Prime Minister, where I remember matters came to a head, in a very mild way. But they did reach a point where he felt that he had to remind the Shah that he could go, he would go if the Shah wanted. But really it was an exercise to ease the path for the Shah to get rid of him rather than any major considerations of politics or administration. Anyway, on that particular occasion, the Shah signaled that he could go on being the Prime Minister. And of course he did. But it's very interesting what you say about the comparison and the contrast between the characters of Hoveyda and Entezam. And in a sense, Entezam emerges as the man who not only is contemptuous of the trappings of power, but is perfectly capable of demonstrating that contempt.
But we mustn't forget, to be fair on Hoveyda, that they were at a different stage of their lives and careers. When Mr. Entezam left, he was nearly 70, whereas Hoveyda in 72 was about 50, 52, something like that.
That's a very good point,
you
yes.
See. So, I mean, it's much easier to give up something when it's
yes.
towards the end and towards the beginning. I'm not saying that this was the reason for it. Mr. Entezam may have done that even if he was 35, but I'm just saying that there is also that to be taken into consideration.
Absolutely, yes.
But you always said that you thought that Hoveyda was totally uncorrupt financially and blameless.
Yes.
In this, you've always maintained that.
Yes.
And indeed, after the revolution, there were two camps of people who blamed the Shah and people who blamed Hoveyda for the debacle of the last few years. But it's very important for future generations to know both sides of the argument, and therefore one should put forward people who blamed him by saying that although he didn't embezzle a lot of money, or indeed none, he allowed other people to do so in a big way. And that if his particular addiction was much more to power than to riches, that doesn't absolve him from the charge of corruption, because if you witness or allow corruption or acquiesce to it, especially if you're in a position of power, you are just as corrupt. And that his particular form of corruption was precisely his addiction to power rather than relinquishing it.
I think we're setting ourselves rather high standards, quite honestly. In that sense, I think the entire human race is corrupt. To get back to Hoveyda, I think it's absolutely true that he was personally untainted by any even rumor of financial malfeasance.
Well, how did he allow his ministers to embezzle so much, which is now all well known?
Yes, well, just remember this, that particularly from 73 on, where the oil price went up and the country became unexpectedly enormously rich, the incidence of corruption increased tenfold, fifteenfold, a hundredfold, I don't really know. But this situation is inevitable whenever you have great wealth and a concentration of political power. It is inevitable. Now, you say, why didn't he resign when his ministers were...
I didn't say why he didn't resign.
Why didn't he?
Number one, how do you choose the ministers? Why choose those people? There were plenty of very integral, admirable people. I recall, for instance, the number two at Ministry of Health, under three or four ministers, was a totally integral, extremely able man. He was never given the chance to become minister precisely because he wasn't embezzling or corrupt or allowing other people to be.
Well, I don't really know that there was a kind of...
He chose the ministers, didn't he?
He chose some of the ministers. He had absolutely no say over the armed forces minister, for instance. He had absolutely no say over the foreign minister. And again, it is inconceivable that he would have chosen someone for any ministry which didn't have HIM's approval, which didn't have the Shah's approval. And of course, ministers had to be vetted by the security organization as well. There was corruption, beyond the shadow of a doubt, there was corruption on a large scale.
I'm only being the devil's advocate and putting other people's opinions.
Yes.
You know.
I'm not absolutely certain what he could have done about it. Now, when criticism of the Shah's regime in later years and in the late 70s became more audible, particularly in the Western press, there were two accusations which were always leveled against it. One was a charge of violating human rights, i.e. torture and mistreatment of prisoners, and the other one was of corruption. Of these two accusations against the Shah's regime, the charge of corruption was the one that rankled Hoveyda far, far greater than the charge of human rights violations.
Why was that?
I don't honestly know, because I suppose it depends on the chemistry of the man. I would have given far greater priority to the other, quite honestly. I remember once when one of the chancellors of one of our universities was in my waiting room and was going to see Hoveyda. He said that he'd just spoken to an American reporter, and the American reporter said, Savak is mistreating people, and there is documented evidence that such and such people have been tortured, etc., etc. And he, this chancellor of the university, said to me, what am I expected to answer in a situation like that? And I, of course, taking my cue from Hoveyda, having sat on many of his interviews with the press, said that I don't know what you should say, but what Hoveyda says in circumstances like this is that if we arrest people who are in the process of planting bombs to kill innocent people, then we don't give them champagne and caviar in our prisons. And he laughed it off in that way. And of course this served as a cue for not only this particular chancellor of the university, but many of his professors. Every time they gave an interview, this was a phrase that I saw with boring recurrence in them. But...
So, you were talking about your experiences at the foreign ministry and Hoveyda's personality and style and relationship with the press.
Yes.
You were talking. But what about his relationship with his own ministers and other political figures, and also people whom he respected and listened to? He loved Mr. Entisham, whom I believe he saw frequently.
He did see frequently, and he would actually, I think, at least at the beginning of his premiership, go and visit Entisham on weekends. But I remember, again, one occasion when, for some reason, Entisham decided to come and see Hoveyda at his office, and talking again about this kind of sufistic fraternity between them, I was astonished to see that Hoveyda actually kissed Entisham's hand. down, the only hand that one kissed, other than ladies, was the Shah's. And
well, you do, I did as find a Sufi, that, you do yeah. kiss the master's hand.
Well, the tremendous gaps in my elementary education in Sufism. I did find that rather a surprising thing. And in the Tehran of those days, it could actually have been interpreted as a gesture of disloyalty. Such was the climate of pervading
fear,
if you like, yes. His relationships with his ministers, I hope it's not disloyal when I say this about Haveda, but while he was an immensely charming, able, and affable man, and the Prime Minister of Iran for 12 years, I think when it really came to the crunch, when it came to major decisions of policy, he was not a powerful figure. I think no Prime Minister of the Shah's after Dr. Amini was more than a figurehead for implementing his own wishes. Let's take a theoretical case. If, say, the Minister of the Armed Forces, the Minister of Defense, as he was called, had been discovered or had had an accusation of corruption leveled against him, Haveda would not have been in a position on his own to dismiss him. The procedure would have been for him to report to the Shah, and if the Shah chose to ignore those allegations, whether justified or not, I don't know, the minister would have stayed on. There was one instance, a rather celebrated instance, when there was a public falling out between the Prime Minister and his then Foreign Minister, Ardeshir Zahedi, you might remember. It was a very minor matter. I think there was a request for decorations, for medals, had to be in by a certain time. And the Foreign Ministry had submitted its list for decorations at a later date than that which had been affixed previously. And when the assistant in charge of the Prime Minister's office had written back to the Foreign Office saying that decorations had to wait till next year because the limit had been passed for that particular year, there was a very rude and public letter, do you remember, from Ardeshir to Haveda, saying that people who had devoted themselves to the cause of serving the sovereign ought not to be denied just reward for the services by sheer bureaucratic mismanagement or arbitrary standards or whatever. And anyway, Haveda sent this letter back, refused to accept it, whereupon Ardeshir wrote his second letter, even ruder than the first. And Haveda took this to the Shah and said, here's your foreign minister writing publicly to me on official stationery, the foreign minister, using such words. Either he goes or I go. And perhaps Haveda didn't actually use that final phrase, but the Shah saw that the Prime Minister was in a very embarrassing spot. And the Shah also knew Ardeshir's rather childlike tantrums and situations like this. And so Ayodhya was booted out of his office. And from then dates, in fact, the start of this feud between Hoveda
and
Zahedi. Well, it was more than resentment, because Feridun Hoveda, Amir Abbas's brother, considered Zahedi as the primary instigator for putting Hoveda in jail when the Shah, in fact, did order him to be detained in 1978, and I think November 78.
What was the power of Ardashir over the Shah?
Well, Ardashir had a personal closeness to the Shah, which Hoveda, at least initially, certainly lacked. As you will recall, it was Ardashir's father who had restored the Shah to his throne in 53. Ardashir himself had his life had been in jeopardy during those months or weeks when the Shah had tried to depose Mossadegh, and Ardashir could have been